Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Friday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a little while, we'll be speaking to the CEO and co-founder of Inner City Helping Homeless, Councillor Anthony Flynn, about the fact 38 people have died in homelessness services in the first quarter of 2021. Twitter has launched a tip jar, but what precisely is it? I'll be joined by tech editor of the Irish Independent, Adrian Weckler. And as you've been hearing in our news bulletins today, the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation is calling for an additional 10 days leave for nurses post-pandemic. I'll be discussing that with Tony Fitzpatrick, Director of Industrial Relations at the INMO.
Feel good. Feel Kildare.
Do remember, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so. Comments, requests, dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email, studio@kfmradio.com, or you can tweet at KFM Radio. Just want to bring a scam warning to your attention. Vodafone is warning customers about scam text messages circulating in other countries. It consists of a fake delivery notification with a bogus website link. The mobile carrier says it's not aware at the moment of this happening in Ireland, but wants to advise the customers just in case it does. Vodafone expects it to affect Android users primarily, but has urged the public to always ignore any suspect text messages. Now, new data compiled by the journal.ie has showed that 38 people who were known to homeless services around Ireland died in the first 3 months of this year. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Anthony Flynn. He is a councillor in Dublin Central, but also chief executive and co-founder of Inner City Helping Homeless. Anthony, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara.
38 people known to homelessness services dying in a three-month period. That must be an incredibly grim record.
It is. It's a figure that's actually shocking in terms of previous years. You know, data in terms of homeless service deaths hadn't been collated by the department previously or stored by the department previously, and they certainly weren't released previously. And we have a situation where last year we've seen 79 deaths in Dublin alone with no actual figure for the rest of the country. So far, for the fourth quarter of this year, we've seen that 30 people have died in Dublin and eight further deaths around the country that have been reported to the department.
Not even collating the data. Anthony, if you or I were to die today, it will be written down somewhere. Someone will collect that data. It will become part of the Central Statistics Office, etc., etc. And it will be used, perhaps, dependent upon the nature of our deaths, to feed into policy. But 79 people, you say, died last year who are connected with homelessness services, 38 this year, and that data isn't being properly collected or collated. How then can you develop policies in order to reduce the number of these deaths?
So I suppose over the last number of years, the National Housing and Homeless Coalition have put pressure on, ICHH have put pressure on the department and Dublin City Council, myself personally with Dublin City Council, in order you know, to produce figures in regard to the number of people that have died in homeless services and in any other social care setting. And as you have said, in regard to national statistics, these deaths would be collated, you know, and they would be recorded. You know, we have these people that are dying within service at the moment are in social care settings in regard to Section 10 funding. But the deaths hadn't been recorded or the deaths hadn't been produced in terms of overall reporting from the department. And they've only recently started to do that. You know, the figure from last year came from Dublin in terms of the 79 deaths. Mm-hmm. And the minister had promised to report on the rest of the city or the rest of the country by March of this year. And he did come out quite blatantly and said in January that by March he would have a report in regard to the overall number of people that died last year right across the country. That report we're still waiting on. This year we've seen a very substantial increase in the amount of people that have died, and we've also seen some reporting coming from the rest of the country in regard to people that are dying at home. Services. You know, we have a very, very serious problem in acute settings in terms of, you know, people that are vulnerable, people that are dying within these facilities. Many of the deaths are happening within private emergency accommodation facilities around the country, you know. So what we need to do, as you say, you know, it's a situation now where we need to create policy to tackle the deaths that we've seen and the deaths that have occurred and the deaths that are going to happen in the future. And we can't do that unless we're reporting correctly in terms of the issue.
The data dispatched by the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive to the Journal shows 16 people died availing of emergency hostels run by charities or private providers. As you've noted, Anthony, three people died on the streets. Another 11 people died in long-term supported housing. And all of those deaths are a tragedy. But what is deeply concerning is what seems to be the year-on-year very, very sharp increase in the number of people who are homeless who are dying. 47 in 2018, 49 in 2019, 79 last year. And certainly if we extrapolate out data that's available to us now, Anthony, for the rest of this year, it could be double that figure.
We're expecting that figure is going to sharply rise. Many of the deaths are in relation to either substance misuse, overdose, or mental health. Mental health is on the increase in regard to tragic deaths that have happened within the system. We've also got to recognise that the Dublin Region Homeless Executive are the only organisation that didn't actually, within the quarterly department reports, produce these figures. We had to go looking for these figures. Other organisations, such as Midlands Region Homeless Executives, have started to report on these figures, such as the 8 deaths that have been seen. You know, the fact of the matter is people are dying. We need to figure out what and get to the root cause of why these people are dying. As I said, you know, from being on the ground, walking in service, and particularly our own teams, our own mental health support teams, are seeing people that are in, you know, such devastating circumstances. Some of the reports that come out within that quarterly report have seen that over 458 children have been in homeless services for two years or more, or 24 months plus. You know, so some of the statistics in relation to why people are dying or why people are still in these services, we need to get to the root cause of exactly what's going wrong here. You know, people shouldn't be dying, and we should be reporting correctly on those figures as well.
Do you have any sense, Anthony, as what could be behind that very stark increase between 2018 and 2020?
Well, I think that, you know, what we've seen is an increase in the amount of people that are accessing homeless services. Mm-hmm. But also, if we look at the empowerment to rights, you know, document that was printed a couple of weeks ago in regard to homeless people that were interviewed, you know, 93% of the individuals that were interviewed in Dublin had stated that they had no exit plan from homeless services. 54% of those people had stated that they had been sexually assaulted within homeless services. There are multifaceted issues in regard to services. There's a big, big issue in regard to private emergency accommodation, and the Deputy Chief Executive of Dublin City Council has himself stated that private emergency accommodation does not provide the same level or standard of care as an NGO sector. And these are for-profit institutions that are making money on the back of homeless services, and they're not providing the same level of care, support and wraparound support services that the NGOs would. So that's a big, big issue at the moment.
You'd wonder why then, Anthony, on that basis, that those contracts continue to be awarded?
Well, again, last year we've seen that we spent over €203 million in terms of the provision of beds and the provision of supports in terms of homeless services. That's a major amount of money. You know, a lot of that went into the private sector. We've seen a lot of the tourist market hotels through COVID-19 have now turned into homeless service units to make beds available. And it's good to see the beds are being made available, but there's absolutely no point in having these beds available if we haven't got the proper rate of care, we haven't got the proper appropriate trained staff within these units, and we're not providing the proper wraparound support services in terms of those units being opened.
But going back to the key point, really, without the proper collection of data, we don't have a true picture of the complexity and the range of issues which may lead to people's...
Or the seriousness of the issues,
because each of them will be a spectrum of experience. And therefore, you cannot put measures in place which could mitigate against those experiences.
100%. And if we look at last year's figure, again, we've only got the 79 deaths that, you know, you say... We haven't seen the whole or the entirety of the situation right across the country, because data hasn't been collated in regard to the different regional homeless executives or the county councils in terms of providing that information to the department. The department requesting that information in regard to how many people have died throughout the country. So we haven't got a realistic figure in terms of how many people have died last year or the year before or the year before that. Although we're seeing, you know, that data that has been collated from Dublin and the year-on-year increase in terms of that, the rest of the country needs to be taken into account. And we need to get a bigger picture and an actual realistic picture of how bad the situation is within homeless services at the moment.
Well, Anthony Flynn, a councillor in Dublin Central, but also chief executive and co-founder of Inner City Helping Homeless, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, the ban on naming child victims of homicide has been lifted from today. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by our courts correspondent, Frank Graney. Frank, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara. Good afternoon to you and your listeners.
Now, this prohibition seems to have been an unintended consequence of elements of the Children's Act. How did it arise and what were its implications?
Well, it's incredible to think that the issue didn't arise until 2019, because Section 252 of the Children Act was actually drafted and enacted 20 years ago. And, you know, it was drafted with the child's interests at heart. It prohibited the media from identifying child witnesses or child victims in court proceedings. And the reason behind it was obviously so that it wouldn't further traumatise a child who potentially has to give evidence in court. But what it failed to do was distinguish between a living child and a deceased child. Mm. It just used the word child victim. So obviously in cases where there's a homicide, the victim is no longer alive. So over the past few years, you know, we have spoken extensively about cases like Anna Creagel, the 14-year-old schoolgirl that I'm sure you and your listeners will be very familiar with. We covered the trial extensively, but by the letter of the law, under Section 252 of the Children Act, Anna Creagel's name shouldn't be revealed publicly after the two boys were charged. So this related to court proceedings. So throughout her entire trial, Anna Creagel's name shouldn't have been used. This came before the court then in 2019, when a mother was about to stand trial accused of murdering her three-year-old daughter. There was an application not to have the child's identity revealed. That was objected to and challenged by a number of media outlets. And it ended up in the Court of Appeal. They ultimately lost at that stage. They lost again before the Court of Appeal because Mr. Justice George Birmingham, the president of the Court of Appeal, in delivering his ruling last October, he said basically the law is plain as day. It's clear. It doesn't make that distinction. And he can't interpret what was in the minds of the lawmakers when they drafted it. He could just look at the wording of that section. Now, what that meant was, you know, since that Court of Appeal ruling, grieving parents haven't been able to speak publicly about their children when they find themselves in these awful situations. And thankfully, there was a political will to change the law, and those changes do take effect now from today.
And I would imagine from on a personal basis that an inability of a parent to speak publicly about their child whose death was unlawful, is it profoundly painful? Because, Frank, I would imagine an awful lot of people listening to you and I have this discussion would say, well, sure, you know, what harm if the media can't name a child victim of homicide? But if their parents cannot talk about them, it's a bridge too far.
And I'm really glad you've asked that question, because there is this misconception that my colleagues and I are chasing people down the street outside courthouses trying to get a comment. That's not the case. You know, we offer people a platform afterwards to come out and talk about their lost loved one, if they so wish. There's never any pressure. Most people don't avail of that opportunity, but the ones who do take great therapy and comfort from it, you know, because court proceedings are so one-dimensional. You know, particularly when it comes to victims and injured parties in cases, you're only really hearing about how they died and who was responsible. You know, and there's always so much more to a victim, a human being. And by offering parents, grieving parents, that platform, they can give the world a better, more grounded picture of who their loved one was and how devastated they are after losing them. I spoke to a woman a few weeks ago whose son was killed in brutal circumstances 2 years ago. Her son's killer was sentenced in February, and she came out afterwards to speak to the media, and we weren't allowed to give her that platform. Behind the scenes then, she and others campaigned to get these changes across the line, and today should have been a day. Celebration is perhaps an inappropriate word to use, but certainly today was going to be the opportunity to give this woman the platform to tell her story. But sadly, there's actually a court order in place restricting the identification of her son. So we weren't actually able to share her words until that order is lifted. That's been adjourned until Monday, and fingers crossed we'll be able to do it then. Kathleen Chadha has been another woman affected by Section 252 of the Children Act. She lost her two boys when her husband Sanjeev took their lives a few years ago, and she has said publicly that she has always felt a great comfort in being able to talk about her boys. You know, because the worst thing about not talking about them is the potential for them to be forgotten. And that's what this is all about. That's what this was always about. It's about giving grieving parents the platform to talk about these things. There were other unintended consequences. If you take historical sex abuse cases, for example, you know, and it does happen where people come before the courts 20, 30, 40 years later, you know, survivors are more often than not grown adults when these things come before the courts. But by the letter of the law, they couldn't be identified because they were considered children under the eyes of the law when the offending took place.
So they couldn't identify themselves.
Exactly, yes. You know, again, this was well-intended legislation in the Children Act. It did have the child's best interest at heart, but, you know, I'm sure the likes of Kathleen Chad and the woman whose story I'll hopefully be able to share, you know, early next week, they'll take great comfort out of the fact that these changes have taken place now, because the woman that I've spoken to extensively over the past few weeks, she said that she's worried about putting things on Facebook. You know, imagine having a moment and you want to share that with your friends, your family, the world, and you can't. You know, I mean, it was truly tragic. And I think the likes of Jim O'Callaghan, you know, Fianna Fáil TD, Michael McDougall, former Justice Minister, former Attorney General, now a Senator, and the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, deserve great credit because they did spearhead this to its fruition.
And they moved, Frank, as quickly as was feasible.
They really did. To have changes to law, to the legislation made as quickly as they were, was remarkable. But you know what else? Here it also shows that where there is a political will,
things can be done quickly.
Way.
Yeah,
things can be done now. You know, it took 6 months, and for the grieving parents, that's perhaps too long. But in the grand scheme of things, when you're moving legislation through the houses, and Jim O'Callaghan, I did watch one of the hearings in relation to suggested amendments, and he made the point that, look, while this is moving swiftly, it's important to get it right. You know, we don't want to find ourselves in a situation 20 years down the line where there is another anomaly. So they've looked at every angle of it, and it's fantastic now that the changes have taken effect.
Well, courts correspondent Frank Graney, thank you indeed for joining us this afternoon to share that with us, and indeed for being so generous with your time. Now, Twitter wants to enable everybody to send cold hard cash to one another. To talk about the Twitter tip jar, I'm joined on the line now by Adrian Weckler. He's a technology editor at the Irish Independent. Adrian, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
Why does Twitter want us to be financially flahoolock with one another?
It's called a tip jar. So the idea is, if there's someone that you like following that you think gives you nuggets of information, or you like the work that they put in, you know, quote-unquote work on Twitter, maybe they are pundits, maybe they keep you informed on various things, maybe you just like them, maybe they have a difficult situation that they've shared with you on Twitter, and Twitter has created a function now that will allow you to directly, you know, quote unquote, tip them. In other words, when you go to somebody's profile on Twitter, there'll be a little icon, which is a tip jar icon, and if you tap that or click that, actually it's tap only, because at the moment it's only for iPhones and Android smartphones, it's not for the web, you will be able to then leave a cash tip through one of a couple of different ways.
This is going to sound like an odd question, but can you reject the tip?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I haven't actually talked about it. I don't think you can.
Because here's my point. Let's say you or I, in our roles as journalists, or elected representatives, for example, somebody just wants to send you money. Nobody's going to want to send you or I money, but let's pretend in hypothetical situation.
Yeah.
Or you know, you're a TD, a member of Congress, a senator, and somebody keeps sending you money, which you cannot reject. But then... That puts you in an ethical quandary.
You raise a good question. Because it's so new, and I haven't actually used it yet, like everybody else, I've only seen that Twitter's introducing it, and I haven't actually used it myself. You're right, there must be a way of rejecting it, because you're absolutely right. What if a stalker starts sending you cash? What if there are campaign finance rules and somebody decides to muddy up your campaign by, you know, sending you 20 quid more than you're allowed, and then tried to make a scandal. You're absolutely right. There must be a way of rejecting it. I mean, some of the tools that they use include PayPal, for example. I don't think you have to accept a PayPal cash transfer. But having said that, I actually haven't used it, so I can't 100% say that you can reject it. But you must be right.
I can see an awful lot of benefits in something like this on Twitter for, you know, micro businesses, for people that are going through hard times and are seeking to raise money and perhaps didn't consider the GoFundMe route or that isn't available to them.
I think what Twitter are more going after here is this new slice of the online, what they call creator economy. It's usually occupied by services and platforms like Patreon. Like if you take, say, for example, there are a couple of podcasts, for example, in Ireland, and instead of having many ads on them or trying to make money that way, or trying to get a sponsor, they're accessed through this Patreon platform, and that's typically is a fiver a month, right? So there's one very high profile one, the former Off the Ball, I can't remember the name now. It was the sports segment on News Talk.
I know the one you're thinking about. The name is escaping me as well. I don't know why. Yeah, it's Friday afternoon.
Off the Ball is actually News Talk, but it's anyway. They went off and set up their own sports podcast. I think they have about 12,000 paying subscribers on Patreon at a fiver a month. So what Twitter is going after is that slice of the market. They think that there is a new business model for people. Maybe they're journalists, maybe they're artists, maybe they're singers, maybe they're essayists, whatever. And they put a lot of work into their online presence, and a lot of people get a lot out of that online presence and want to contribute to support that person or that entity so that they'll keep on doing it. That's the idea.
And what kind of commission are they charging, Adrian?
I don't think Twitter are charging much of any commission. I think some of the payment services do. I think PayPal, for example.
PayPal charges, does charge.
Yeah, I think PayPal charges. I've seen percentages up as high as 20-30%.
Wow.
But typically percentages, they're usually in the single digit figures. Some services like GoFundMe, for example, they're not obligatory anymore. They ask you, do you want to voluntarily also chip in a small proportion or percentage to GoFundMe to keep the platform active, but you don't have to.
It's going to be interesting to see how this works in the real world and how people are going to use it in future.
Yeah, I mean, I can see a niche for it, all right. You can see some examples where, let's say you have, for example, a contracting media, and let's say there are a lot of high-profile and relatively well-regarded, say, journalists or pundits. Now, let's say the industry can't sustain them anymore. Mm. By the way, I'm not talking about you or I, right? I'm not taking a personal example, but I'm just saying that this is the thinking. It's possible that that person may not find a permanent role or job somewhere else for a while, but it's possible that their work, you know, quote unquote, may still be regarded as valuable on an online platform like Twitter. We think of the media as being radio, newspapers, TV. Actually, the media is also online platforms, some like Twitter's also YouTube. There are a lot of genuine first-person newsbreakers or reviewers or whatever, or influencers, and that's a dirty word, but influencer can also be a culture influencer, somebody who sets the culture agenda for a lot of people. A lot of those people live exclusively on platforms like YouTube and Twitter, and you can kind of see where, you know, you or I might follow one or two or three or four or nine or ten of them, and we want them to, you know, we want them to be sustainable. So that's the thinking.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how people use it, if people get on board with it, and the type of people they elect to patronise. Adrian Weckler, tech editor at the Irish Independent, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation's call for an extra 10 days leave for members. Now, nurses and midwives have again called on the Health Minister to answer their long-standing request for additional annual leave days. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Tony Fitzpatrick. He's Director of Industrial Relations at the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Tony, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
I know that the organisation, on behalf of its 42,000 members, submitted this request for 10 days additional leave each post-pandemic to the HSE in November, up to, I think, this morning, or certainly last night. No response had been forthcoming. Minister Stephen Donnelly addressed the delegate conference online this morning. Had he anything to say to that matter?
No, he basically along the lines of what he has said before, and indeed on Taoiseach addressed our conference yesterday and outlined that they will recognise nurses and midwives and healthcare workers for their commitment. But we've heard that from the Minister, we've heard it from the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste for a number of months now. But what we haven't seen and what the members are growing increasingly frustrated at is that they're hearing words from ministers and from the government and the HSE, and what they actually want is action and recognition. And the key thing about this is we lodged a claim with regards to this issue back in November, but in many other jurisdictions, and indeed on this island, up in Northern Ireland, the governments have recognised the contribution of healthcare workers during the pandemic. In Scotland, Wales, they're our nearest neighbours. They have all recognised it, and they all did it of their own fruition. They didn't have to wait for unions to pursue claims
and when you say recognise, Tony, what form does that recognition take in those jurisdictions you mentioned?
Well, in those jurisdictions, what amounted in, for example, in Scotland was a €5,000 after tax payment made to all healthcare workers. In Wales, they made a payment of that was sterling, obviously, and in Wales they made a payment of €735, which amounted again to an amount of €500 after tax. France made a payment of €1,200. Austria, €500. So all around the world, you'll see where Taiwan, they have given a contribution to the staff in recognition. And I think it's important. You know, what was said in those jurisdictions by those health ministers was applause was never enough. Our appreciation must be shown in a tangible way. Mm. You worked at the sharpest end of the COVID trauma and you deserve recognition now. And in Wales, they outlined that you've shown a remarkable amount of commitment and courage from the initial outbreak. You've suffered the impact of the pandemic, as many people have, but it's had a significant impact on healthcare workers' mental and physical health. And today at conference, we heard from nurses and midwives that are survivors of COVID and are still suffering from long COVID, which has had a major debilitating effect on their lives. So I think it's like many things. The government needs to act now on this. They need to give that recognition now because nurses and midwives still are responding to the call. They're trying to do their own jobs. They're rolling out vaccination clinics and delivering vaccines as we currently speak. The vaccine delivery will be ramped up in the coming weeks. And again, that's going to fall back on nurses and midwives and other healthcare professionals to deliver those vaccines. So I think it would be a good step by the government to stop talking about it and actually take some action.
Or arguably to be more concrete in what it is that they propose to do, because Tony, from what you've relayed to us, comments by Micheál Martin and Stephen Donnelly respectively on this matter seem extremely nebulous.
Exactly, and nebulous is the word, Ciara, a very good word for it, because I can't, after Minister Donnelly addressed our conference this morning, the sense of disappointment, and obviously, you know, we're doing a virtual conference and we're talking about the chat, and the key line was, all words, no action, no tangible announcement. And I think that's what's key now. They need to say, and look, we're not talking that staff get holidays now.
Yeah.
We have staff, obviously, that haven't taken their holidays from last year and there's holidays due this year, etc. But sit down with us in a room with the unions that represent healthcare workers and work out some recognition for these healthcare workers. Other jurisdictions did it. If they've done it in Northern Ireland, surely they can do it in the south of Ireland. And I think they need to step forward now and actually recognise what the contribution of healthcare workers has been during this crisis. They went to work. they got sick at work. And I think there's a need that that is recognised and done now.
Because I think virtually everybody in the entire country is really, really tired. And that is us who are not frontline healthcare workers going about our day-to-day lives living in a pandemic. I cannot imagine the level of exhaustion of anybody who is in any kind of a frontline role, but particularly in a healthcare setting, that they must be feeling at this juncture.
You're right, Ciara. That is absolutely, and you're right. We all, I'm sure you do, and I do. I feel tired certain days as well. But the profound impact of pandemics. If you're an ICU nurse, the level of while they did incredible work, and Ireland had some of the best outcomes from intensive care units in the world, and that's because we have great qualified doctors and nursing working in intensive care units. But the level of death that they had to deal with, nurses and midwives, you know, working on COVID wards, the level of death, dealing with the emotion of no visitors into that person that's dying, that they talking to the family over the phone, the emotional toll of that has had an impact on nurses and midwives. And we see it in our surveys that we're doing, that many are thinking about leaving the profession because they have been profoundly impacted by it. And even in the community, where, you know, they've been running hubs, they've been doing vaccination centres, they've contact tracing and trying to do their own job, their first visits, the babies in the homes, etc., caring for the elderly, doing their clinical work in the community. It's been extremely stressful and they are exhausted. And a concern we have is that, you know, we hear Paul Reid talk about there's not a big impact on our hospital system, etc. We're going to start opening up things again. And they shudder with fear because of the level of work that they're currently doing. We're already beginning to see some overcrowding within hospitals, and they are just exhausted. And I think it would be important. It might give them a little lift if the government made an announcement now, engaged with the unions, and agreed something with regards to recognising these staff at this time.
Well, Tony Fitzpatrick, Director of Industrial Relations at the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, thank you indeed for joining us.